I haven't been asked, but I'm pressured by you to recount lurid details. I am not a victim. I am a survivor. And by telling my story, it has empowered me. And I encourage other women to take this situation and turn it around and let it empower them so they can experience post-traumatic growth.
I want to thank you all for being with us, Louise Godbold, Tomianne Roberts, as well as Irene Carmon. This is Democracy Now!
Good morning. It's 7:59. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Voices from the Edge in just about 1 minute. Our host, Lisa Loving, welcomes Giovanni Schern, the founder of Up and Over, to talk about their winter coat drive for teenagers and also her advocacy for houseless Oregonians. That's coming up, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of All the Rage, Thursday, October 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. All the Rage is a documentary that explores the work of physician Dr. John Sarno and his radical methods to treating back pain. Through the interviews with Sarno, patients, and experts, the film offers a profound rethink of how we approach our healthcare. Again, that's All the Rage, Thursday, October 12th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Sitting in for Joanne Hardesty, I'm Lisa Loving. And today, what can you personally do to help vulnerable people during the harsh winter months? Our guest is Up and Over founder Giovanni Schern. She founded this incredible organization supporting kids, and they're holding their annual winter coat drive for teenagers. Giovanni's also an advocate for houseless and mentally ill Oregonians, and we're really excited to have her here today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I feel really honored to be here, actually. Thank you.
Thanks. Listeners, these are crunchy times, and there's a lot of bad going on. But what I love about Giovanni's work is she brings solutions. She just brings them. She's got a solutions factory. And so I want to start, Giovanni. Talk about Up and Over. What do you do?
So Up and Over is a foundation that focuses on helping youth in middle school and high school. It was founded in 2011, March of 2011. So we're actually coming up on our seventh year. I keep saying six, but we basically started out just going into schools, high schools, middle schools, and sharing our stories of getting up and over our own obstacles as a way to demonstrate to young people that they could also do that. And then we would end with performances. And so it was just an idea that came about because Up and Over was supposed to be a program for women in recovery because my mom was a recovering addict. She was murdered 25 years ago, and that's still unsolved. But I thought after a conversation with a young person, it's like, why will we wait until people need recovery? It's like waiting on the other side of the bridge for someone to fall in the water instead of teaching them how to build a boat to get across the water. So the idea was we want to help young people not need recovery. And so we were going to do that by just showing them that they could overcome certain obstacles. By our second year, schools were asking us, you know, this is great. You know, you guys are really connecting with our youth. What else you got? And I'd be like, nothing. We don't have anything. Like, I didn't think this through. And so it just eventually over the years evolved into workshops. It evolved into mentoring. We started doing different types of presentations. I do speaking gigs on my own sometimes to educators. I have a workshop that I have called Evolution of a Bully that helps educators understand what's behind that behavior from my perspective, because I was a bully in high school. And usually people are angry at me because they've been bullied in the past, but it's a learning experience for them to really kind of talk to a bully and, you know, learn how I overcame that behavior. I know you're looking at me like,
that's completely fascinating.
You're not a bully. I know. I look at this face. There's no way I'm a bully. but yes, I was. And so, you know, we just kind of evolved as we saw need, and we were in the schools and we were able to do things. And like I said, that evolved into mentoring, to workshops, to different types of presentations. And so we kind of focus on Oregon and Washington middle schools and high schools, but yeah, we've been doing that for a minute.
Can we dig into that a little bit more?
Yeah.
If I had known that about the bullying workshop, that's a whole show of its own. That is so fascinating. It's an issue that's impacting our entire nation.
Yeah.
But so I feel like we're going to have to put that in a little Ziploc bag and put it to the side, because it's too. We were just listening to Democracy Now! Talking about the president, so right. it will swallow our entire show.
All right.
But what? So when you say you do workshop, first of all, I want to say, it makes me happy to think schools are inviting you in. What schools are we talking about? Can you name names of schools? Because we want to know good things are happening.
Oh, my
there.
Goodness. Gosh, we've done Roosevelt a couple times. We've done so many schools. Our first year, we did 27.
Wow.
Yeah, we've been in Portland Public Schools. We've been in David Douglas School District, Beaverton, Vancouver, Clackamas. Like, we've just been everywhere. And our first couple years, we were going as far as 4 hours into Washington. You know, we're going to places like Sultan, Washington, Riddle, Oregon, places I've never even heard of. So to go into 27 schools our first year, I didn't realize at the time what a big deal that was, because back then it was hard to get into schools and just, hey, give us access to your youth and let us say whatever we want to say, because at that time we really didn't have reputation or any references or anything. It was literally just, hey, this is what we like to do, can we do it? And to do 27 schools our first year is a pretty big deal. So we've done a lot of schools.
That makes me happy on this day, especially.
Yeah.
What kind of issues do you do the workshops about, aside from the bullying issue? What are some of the other, just toss them out like jelly beans. What are some of the other workshops you do? I'm curious.
Yeah.
I need a workshop right now.
So we have, let me say that we partnered with a mental health professional as we were developing these workshops, because our first year was just, let's do a workshop. And then we'd get in these groups with these young people, and they would share things with us that we weren't really equipped to deal with. And so we kind of took a break for a little bit. And so it's like, oh, I still want to do this, but we need to do this right. And so we've partnered with the Bletson Group out of Washington, who helped design some of our workshops. So we have this workshop called Achieve Against the Odds, and it's a 6-series workshop. And everything that we do really focuses on equipping young people. You know, I say all the time that schools do what schools do. They teach students to be good students, to be good college students, to be good employees, right? We want to teach them to be good people who make good decisions about education, about employment, about relationships. So everything we do focuses on that. So we have the one called Achieve Against the Odds. We have some intention setting things in there, some truths in there, some things that, just life things that they could learn to take control of the decisions that they make. I'm real big on accountability, but a lot of times we expect young people to be accountable for things that we struggle with, and they don't have the knowledge to make the right choices, and so giving them that power back. So Achieve Against the Odds is, like I said, it's a 6-series workshop. I do the Evolution of a Bully workshop, and that's really kind of our main two things that we do. Just recently, 2 years ago, we developed a workshop for parents. It's a because I'm real big on it really takes a village, and I learned that personally this last year, but it really takes a village. So we need to equip the teachers, the parents, or the home, you know, the home life of the student, and then the student. So everyone's saying the same thing, is all on the same page. So we have workshops also for teachers, educators, and for parents. And it's a variation of the evolution of a bully piece to help educators understand some things, help parents self-identify how they might be contributing to the behavior, but also help them understand how to advocate for their student if they are being bullied. So I'm just trying to do a lot, I guess.
If you just tuned in, this is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio, sitting in for Joanne Hardesty. I'm Lisa Loving, and we're talking with Up and Over founder Giovanni Schoen. How did you come to the coat drive? Where did that come from?
So this is our fifth year for the coat drive. In the first year, it wasn't a thing. It was just there were some young people in our mentoring program that we noticed didn't have coats in the weather that you would typically have a coat for. And we learned through conversations with the parent that they were actually homeless. And so, you know, it's kind of hard when you approach people about, hey, I want to do something for you. You don't want to offend anybody. You don't want to come off wrong. And so, you know, it was just kind of like, hey, it was put on my heart to help your boys. Just let me know if there's anything that, you know, they need. And so the mom was very forthcoming. I actually knew her previously about their situation. You know, they were living in a car and they didn't have really anything. And so I just initially that first year, I just put a call out on my social media. Hey, we have these young boys who, need some things. Of course, the community came together and we were able to get them gift cards and coats and shoes and school supplies and all that stuff. But what I was struck by was, you know, we took them shopping for the coats, and I just stood in the background, let the parents and them do their thing. But just to see the look on their face and see how enjoyable of an experience it was, number one, but just to have something new. You know, we always, you know, we have that where you get your new shoes, you think you can run faster. There's just something when you have, this is mine, you know. And I know this family, and they would have gladly accepted used things. Like, they're just that type of people where it's like, I'm just thankful. I appreciate anything that anyone does, and they're giving as well. But to get something new, I could see on the, you know, the looks on the boys' faces, how that impacted them. And so by year two, it's like, okay. Oh, let me back up a little bit. So because of the great response from the community, I actually had enough money to buy five more coats, to take five more students shopping for coats. So by the second year, it's like, okay, let's double that. Let's do 14. Third year, hey, let's double that. Let's do 25. Last year, the goal was 50, and we did 46. And so this year, I've doubled that, of course. So the goal is 100 coats. And what we do, what's different about our coat drive is we collect funding, sponsorships, and we actually take the youth to shop for, find, try on their very own coat. And that's, you know, kind of what's different about our coat drive.
Mm. And again, we're speaking with Giovanni Schoen. You may have just woken up.
Yeah.
This is, I'm so excited to have Giovanni in the studio today because
thank you.
Your family is such an incredible story. I really believe you should write a book about your entire family.
Thank you.
So we just talked about the coat drive. We're going to talk about it again before the end of the show. But there's something about your work, the work you've done with kids, that then something happened in your own family. And last year, a whole bunch of things for you converged. Can you talk about your son? Talk about what you did with your son last year. Because I hope y'all are sitting down, because this, I was on the edge of my seat watching Giovanni, social media, the story of what she did last year. And I'm just going to try not to cry right now. So go ahead.
Oh, me too. I'm going to try not to cry because it is a year pretty much.
Journey.
It's been a year. So it all ties together for me, because what did happen with my son makes this coat drive even so much more personal, because I, you know, I saw him homeless at that time. So, gosh, June 2016, my son was released from the Oregon State Hospital. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia at the age of 22. I was not notified that he was released. I didn't find out until about 2 weeks later. And so I looked for him by myself for about a week.
You looked for him where?
I looked for him where I thought homeless people would be. I just really didn't know anything about like where his mind was. And so I would go to shelters. I was downtown. I was at malls, you know, showing him people his picture. I was at rescue missions. I was at parks because I had heard that he had been seen in a park downtown. And so I was just everywhere I could be by myself, but I couldn't be everywhere. And so about a week looking for him on my own, you know, I kind of swallowed my pride. I had to, because there is a stigma with mental health. You know, I'm thinking, oh my goodness, if I tell people my son has schizophrenia, then they're going to be looking at me like, what did she do? What didn't she do? What could she have done different? And so I just had to prepare myself for that, because I really didn't grow up understanding mental health, right? And so I finally was like, you know, I gotta find my son. And so I went to my Facebook page and I wrote this long old, you know, be kind to people thing. And by the way, I need you to help me find my son. And within 2 days, I knew where my son was, because the community stepped up and said, you know, I think I see him over here, and I've seen him over here, and I've seen him over here. And then one lady that I don't know saw it, because people were sharing it. You know, it was shared, I think I looked, and it was like 700 times or so. And that's a lot, you know, on Facebook.
In this area.
Yeah, in just in this area. And so someone saw, their friend posted about it, and she messaged me and said, you know, I think I've seen this guy. I actually gave him food every day for a week because he was eating out of the garbage can by the Clackamas Town Center. And, you know, that just broke my heart, because I'm safe at home, and I'm, you know, I can turn my heat on and turn it off when I get too hot. And my son is outside, you know, digging in the garbage cans for raisins. And so we just figured out where he was and kind of what his pattern was. And I was like, you know, is there anybody out there that can help me find him? Because I cannot be, you know, we got these three solid leads. And again, community stepped up. We had two people going out to Gresham, two people going downtown, and I was headed to Oregon City. And I didn't even get to my location before I got a phone call, and they're like, we found Chris. And I couldn't believe it. It's like, are you sure? Are you sure? And they're like, yeah, we're sitting here right here talking to him. I'm like, are you sure it's him? Do you know what he looks like? Do you remember what he looks like? And they put him on the phone, and it was him. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm coming to get you. And he said, no, thank you. And I just started crying, because it's like, it's 10 o'clock at night. Like, where are you going? And he said, you know, I have my friend Matt. And so that gave me some relief. I wouldn't find out until later that there was no friend Matt. And so he said, you know, I'll call you tomorrow. And he never called me. And so again, it's like, hey, yay, everybody, I did find my son, but I need to find him again. And I knew at that time that he probably wasn't on his meds. And I needed to find him and just make sure for myself that he was okay. And so we tracked him down. And again, just people saying, hey, I saw him over here at this time on this street. He's always over here at this time. And so I posted up downtown on 4th and Taylor and waited for him the next day. And like clockwork, he showed up, and he looked so bad. I mean, he looked so bad. His pants were torn, like knee to knee in the crotch. He was dirty. His hair was matted. His beard was matted. He just looked really bad. And so, of course, as a mother, I'm looking at him like, let me take you home and, you know, take a shower and give you some food. And he said, no, thanks. And I was like, okay, because at that time I just didn't know how to deal with him. Like, I hadn't really had time to research how do I deal with my son who's battling this mental illness. All I knew is I need to get my son off the street. So I did that 3 days in a row, and like clockwork, he showed up on 4th and Taylor. And so one day I showed up with a backpack full of stuff, and he's like, I can't take that. And I said, well, you know, why not? He said, I just can't. So again, it just reinforced for me that the mental illness, you know, he was still battling with some paranoia. And so, you know, kind of wrapping that all up, my last hope was I knew that there was a warrant out for him for failure to appear at court. And so I called the police. And I was like, he's over on 4th and Taylor. You need to go get him. Because I was thinking they're going to pick him up, and then they're going to get him help. And they released him the next day. And so I'm like, dang, you know, what is my next plan? Because that was my big plan. It was to get him help, if not home. And so I just started looking for solutions and trying to talk to him. And so I just put out this call to the community to keep an eye on him, so I know where he's at, where I figure out what I'm doing, which they did. And I came to the conclusion eventually that I'm going to get guardianship of him. And so by this time, we're in like October. And so it's like right now, just yesterday, I posted on Facebook a memory that I had signed the guardianship, you know, the papers. And so we petitioned the court a year yesterday, and it was a long process. I didn't actually get guardianship until November 28th. And so for those 2 months, and this is, you know, this is makes me emotional, because the community for those 2 months, because my son wouldn't take anything from me, I had put a call out, hey, can someone meet me out at the Gresham Transit Center? I have food to give my son, but he won't take it from me. And so many people stepped up. Like, I had someone every day for 2 weeks that would meet me or go out on their own to give my son food and water and, you know, cigarettes and bus fare and whatever he needed. And so as it started getting colder, he had on a little sweater. Someone donated a coat for him. And we actually went through 3 coats, because he would take the coat, but he wouldn't put the coat on. And he would just leave them. And so that kind of circles back to why the coat drive is important to me, because the night that we served my son his papers, I stayed out there with Rachel, I love her, stayed out there to 4 o'clock in the morning after all this hoopla of trying to get them to do a welfare check on him and you know, just pick him up, because I saw him cold, hunched over, walking like he was in pain, but he was just, you know, in shoes that were too big. He was cold, and I just broke down. So I stayed out at the Gresham Transit Center until 4 o'clock in the morning, until my son literally laid down on the ground to sleep. And he did take a small jacket, but he didn't take like the socks and the shoes and stuff from us. But I watched my son sleep outside. And so that was really, really tough for me. And so for that month, just making sure that he had food and water and had money to get on the bus during the day when it was cold was really the goal while I waited for this guardianship paper.
Let me jump in and say, you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Sitting in for Joanne Hardesty, I'm Lisa Loving. We're live in Studio 2 with Giovanni Shern. She's the founder and executive director of Up and Over. You know, she also has been appointed by the governor to the board of directors of the Oregon State Hospital. She's sharing the story with us right now of how, I'm just going to say, you reclaimed your son from the street.
Yeah.
And please continue.
Yeah. So, so we finally got guardianship. And again, that whole waiting process was crazy, but the community stepped up. So While I was waiting, people were sending me pictures of him. They were messaging me saying, I saw your son. I gave him $5. I saw your son. I gave him a bus pass. I saw your son. I gave him some food. It was amazing how many people came together. And I actually kept track of everyone. And it was 53 people.
People, you listening right now, that's you. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No. It's amazing when I think about it. And these weren't people that I knew.
It wasn't a bureau.
No, right. And it wasn't my friends and family only. These were strangers because people were sharing, you know, hey, she's looking for her son. So people would send me pictures of him. He's on the number 4. He's headed over here. And so then I'd say, hey, who could meet me out here? He's on this bus. Let's get him some food. And people were doing it. I mean, sometimes people would sit out at the Gresham Transit Center for hours waiting for him, for hours waiting for my son. And these were strangers sometimes. And so it is really amazing how everyone came together and looked out for my son. I remember one person messaged me and said, you know, hey, I'm on the bus with homeboy. You know, what you want me to do? And I'm like, you know, just see if he needs anything, or just chat with him, make sure he's okay. And he messaged me back and he said, you know, your son is the most famous homeless person in Portland because everybody knows about him and everybody's looking out for him. And that really touched me, and I really appreciated that. What it did for a lot of people, I got a lot of messages from people saying, you know, my brother, my mother, my loved one suffered from mental illness. They weren't ready to post it publicly, but they felt comfortable sharing that with me. And so just to share those conversations with people was great too. And I think, you know, coming out with my story, people looked at homelessness different. Then they looked at mental health different, if even for just those 2 months. There was one lady that posted my son's picture, and she was making fun of him. And he did look bad. I mean, he looked really bad. And he was asleep on the bus. She posted the picture. She's not a friend of mine on social media, but someone who is a friend of someone, like 3 people removed, they're like, is this your son? Like, it is. And I noticed that she was making fun of him. And so I messaged her on Facebook directly. And I said, I just want you to know his story. And so I kind of told her what was going on. And she said, you know, I have this thing where I take pictures of strange things I see on the bus. And she said, I will never do that again. Never again. And so for me, and I thanked her. I said, you know, even you posting that, making fun of him, let me know that he was alive. So I appreciate that. And she said, you know, I'll never do that again. And for me, that was a big step. Like, he's making a difference, you know, not just me and everybody else, but he's actually helping change people's perceptions. So it was it was amazing for me. So kind of jumping ahead, I got the guardianship, and I thought this is going to give me the power to go get him help. And I learned very quickly that that's not how guardianship works. I had, you know, again, he wouldn't deal with me because of his paranoia. And I want people to know, a lot of times it's the parents or the loved ones that folks with mental illness do shy away from, because we're usually the ones saying, you need help, I'm gonna, you know, take you to the hospital. And so they shy away from that. If someone was telling you that you needed mental health and you didn't believe it, you would probably avoid those people too. So I didn't take that personal. It's like I had come to the conclusion that I'm ready to accept that he will never appreciate me. He doesn't even have to love me. He's not staying on the streets. Like, I was ready to just accept that. So we got him to the hospital. And of course, he didn't meet criteria because he wasn't.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah,
oh,
he wasn't gonna. And when we went there, it was like, oh my God, this is what we've been waiting for, right? To get him to the hospital. And they released him the next day. Within a week, he had an episode and was taken to Kaiser Sunnyside. I won't mention the other hospital, the first hospital, because I don't have anything good to say about them. But Kaiser Sunnyside was amazing. Everybody over there was amazing. They treated him with respect. They were compassionate to my position, to his position, and they really looked out for him. But so that led to Cedar Hills, which led to Telecare Residential, and that whole thing, getting him from Cedar Hills to Telecare Residential Service was a battle in itself. That's where I learned that the system is not really set up to help me help my son. Even with guardianship, I was struggling to help him, but I wasn't going to give up. So I had to do some legwork to help Cedar Hills understand the process of getting him transferred to Telecare. And it, you know, I'm one of those parents that I'm going to be in the business. You know, I was calling Telecare so much. When you call up there, they ask you for the patient ID so they can get you to the right place. But I call up there and I'd be like, yeah. And they're like, oh, you're Chris's mom. It's like, yeah. I don't even have to tell you his number because you recognize my voice. Because I'm going to call up here every day, every hour if I have to make sure that you guys are taking care of my son. So he went to Telecare, which is amazing. He was there for, I think, 5 months. And he came home in May. So he's been home since May. He's had to go to respite a couple times because of medication adjustments, but you know, so far so good. It's still a learning process for me, you know, how to best serve and deal with him and make sure that he's having some, you know, type of peace of mind. He's actually at respite today. I had to take him yesterday because of a medical medication change. And, you know, I don't want him like a zombie, you know, because that's easier for me. I want him to have a life. You know, we've had to make some adjustments. I have to move the furniture so he has room to pace. You know, we have to kind of maneuver around him. He's 6'2", so he takes up, you know, he's has a presence.
And you've got other kids at home.
I do. I have a younger 15 and 17-year-old. And so we've had to have conversations, you know, and just let them know to what to expect. You know, Chris giggles to himself sometimes because he still hears voices. He paces. He has this preoccupation with our dog, which, you know, might be something I have to address. But we've had to make some changes, but it's still new to us. So that story about how the community came together, you know, was in the Oregonian, and that's how someone from the Oregon State Hospital Advisory Board saw it, contacted me, and said, I'd like to nominate you. And so that's how the whole board thing happened.
And member of the Oregon State Hospital Board.
Yes, advisory board. And I'm a voting member, which is awesome. I get to vote on stuff.
If you just tuned in, you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Sitting in for Joanne Hardesty, I'm Lisa Loving. We're speaking with Giovanni Shern. She runs a nonprofit organization she founded. She advocates for houseless and mentally ill Oregonians. I want to ask her more about the Oregon State Hospital in a minute. But first, it's half past the hour, and we haven't even opened the phone lines yet because I just am on the edge of my seat with this epic story. We do have a caller, but I want to say, listeners, we know many of you have DIY projects helping the houseless. So what are you working on now? Call us with your project. Let us know how we can support you. And if you know of a great program supporting mentally ill people, tell us about it. Let us know how we can support it. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. And we do have a caller. We have Jeremy. Jeremy, what's going on with you today?
Oh, as usual, a fair amount. Sorry, I'm trying to turn the speaker. Okay, there we go. I'm sorry, I didn't hear all of it, but, and I want to offer my, you know, deepest sympathy for how difficult your struggle has been. I think in the last couple of days in the news, I think in Washington, there's was a law which I don't know if it passed or failed to pass, but anyway, basically, families want to have more rights to get their children into psychiatric custody. And I wanted to offer a different perspective on that, because in the late 60s, before I was 21, which was the age majority there, I was brought into custody and almost killed. And I'm not going to deny that I was acting strangely and needed help. However, the reason that laws that civil rights were extended to people accused of being mentally ill is that until those laws were extended to protect them, psychiatrists and families were going nuts. That's a bad word. They were very aggressive, and I believe often very hurtful.
I agree. Their
children, and I was a victim of that. I consider myself an ex-inmate of mental hospitals. Approximately 30 to 40% of people who receive a certain classification of drugs for any period of time will have brain damage, and this is never discussed. And I certainly hope that's not the sort of medicine in quotes, I would call them drugs, that have been administered to your child.
All right.
It seemed like your ability to intervene was helpful to your kid. My family and the state's ability to intervene literally against me was not helpful to me. It took several years of my life, and anyway, I won't go on about that.
Jeremy, I just want to say how much I appreciate your calling and sharing your story from an experienced person's point of view. And while you were talking, I have to say, Giovanni was shocked. She was nodding her head. And I noticed that, Giovanni, you did not advocate for your son to be put in a facility. You wanted him home with you. And that's where you're working towards. But Jeremy, that's a hot bubbling pot, and you put it right on the table.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, I apologize for missing the point.
No. I think you drew a line underneath the whole point.
Yeah,
actually.
And can I just say, I understand where you're coming from, because I wouldn't want someone to have, the ability to just say, hey, I don't agree with Giovanni or she's acting strange, let's put her in the hospital. I wouldn't want that for anybody, but I had to look at my son and the decisions that he was making. You know, he wasn't able at that time to care for himself. And so because there's no supports in place for families to help them without getting guardianship or power of attorney or civil commitment, you know, that's where the system fails. And I agree with you. I should be able to help my son without taking away his ability to think for himself. And so I try, just so you know, I try very hard to include him in every decision that is made. Hey, they're changing your medication. This is what it's going to do. How do you feel about that?
How about if he wakes up one morning and says, I don't want medication?
We already discussed what happened when that happened.
Yeah. he, without his medication, he has a lot of the negative symptoms of schizophrenia. And so when he's not on his medication, he's just not making decisions from a safe place. I'll just put it like that. And so with the meds, and let me tell you, he's actually at respite now, because I'm not sure that the meds that they have him on is what's best for him. And so I prefer that he be somewhere where they're adjusting those, because I don't want him to be like a zombie. I want him to have a quality of life, but I also want him to be safe. And I don't want him sleeping outside in 30-degree weather, and I don't want him eating raisins out of the garbage can. So it's a fine line. It's, you know, when you have someone who cares, how are they letting, or how are they helping us help our loved ones? And the only options that they give us are these legal ones. And so it's really difficult. Like, I want to help him, but the way they set it up is I can't just go and help him. They won't even tell me anything about him. You know, hey, how is he doing? What meds are you giving him? So I'm informed, unless I have this legal paper. And I think there's gotta be a gray area somewhere where we who want to help our loved ones can help them without having to do this extreme. So I understand what you're saying. I really appreciate you sharing your story. It takes a lot of courage, especially in these times, to really come forward and say, I was struggling with this. So I appreciate that.
What do you think,
okay,
Jeremy?
I didn't hear the beginning of the broadcast, and the thing I then went on to work in mental hospitals for a couple of years, some years later, and what I saw over and over again, sometimes just inferred it from reading charts, is that the mishandling of the first or second hospitalization, the first or second crisis,
that is so interesting.
Usually it's the younger person. Usually there's some conflict or bad behavior around the family. The absolute worst people are called cops, who are usually, you know, recruited out of the military and have the social work skills of Adolf Hitler, and then they're brought to an emergency room, and since often the situation's been dealt with adversarially and combatively, especially young men will often fight back. And then it just gets worse and worse and worse. And on that first hospitalization, you tell someone, you've got a disease, this is the cure. And what they learn is that this miserably, viciously sedating and brain damaging, quote, medicine is the way that they're supposed to deal with their pain or their surfeit of energy or whatever. And then after you've got them on it for a while, if they stop taking it, of course, it's got, bad behavior is going to come back. So right. I'd really like to see that first couple of encounters with, quote, medicine and loss of liberty to, for the quote patient, I would call them, I didn't have patients, I had clients. I'd like to see them have a real advocate. And I'd also like them to have, people who are really versed and in dealing with people in crisis, which I don't even think psychiatric nurses are particularly good at, since they're trained that people have diseases. I'd really like to see a whole different type of staff and a whole different type of response to people, in their late teens and early 20s having trouble.
Jeremy, you're so awesome.
Yeah.
I hope you call back again sometime. I kind of want to meet you now.
Yeah.
And I hope that wherever you are and whatever you have going, it's working well. Because we were going to I wanted to shift this conversation because Giovanni's now on the board of directors, the advisory board of the Oregon State Hospital. And I wanted to, if we could, shift the conversation and talk about what issues she sees there. And you've been to a few meetings. What is your vision for the work you're doing there? Because that's exactly what Jeremy's talking about.
Yes.
He just changed our channel for us perfectly.
Yes. So my son's first experience was at the Oregon State Hospital. And my son was there on what they call a 370, which is he went there because he was unable to aid and assist. And he was there a year and a half, which the typical time for that, the goal is 90 days. And he was there a year and a half. And what Jeremy is saying is true. I feel like at that time they were just throwing meds at him because the goal was to get him, not necessarily to help him, but to get him back to court. And that, I didn't understand that until, of course, he was released, right? I'm thinking, oh, yay, he's in the hospital. He's getting help. I'm so happy for my son. And when you're there on that type of commitment, the goal is different. And so, and I wouldn't learn that until later. So what Jeremy is saying is true. And that's kind of where my heart is too. Like everyone should be treated in a way that's going to help them get better and help them move forward, not just to kind of medicate them and move them on. So being on the board, my first meeting, I just kind of sat there and listened. I said a couple things. But this next meeting, they knew I was there for sure. There's issues. I love this board because it's so diverse. It's made up of 16 people that include family, that include staff, that include some of our political folks, that include nurses, that include staff. And the part that I love the most is it includes patients, current patients. So current patients come in.
What?
Yes.
Current patients? That's cool. Oregon State Hospital Citizens Advisory Board.
Yeah.
That's
cool. It's like a peer. Yeah. But they come in and there's two or three of them and they come in and they tell us the real deal about what's going on at the hospital. And here's what we would like to see. Here's what we've been saying. Hear our voice. So I love that the board has them be a part of that whole process. And one thing I did learn about being on that advisory board is there are people who work in mental health, and then there are people who really advocate for people dealing with mental illness. And you can believe that I'm one of the people who are advocating for the people that are at that hospital. I don't want someone else to come out with no support. That was the issue with my son. He came out with no support. And I've learned that that was just a glitch in procedure, because I should have been notified. I should have been part of that process. But when my son first went to the hospital, he didn't give them permission to talk to me. And so that was in his file, you know, mom doesn't get information. Well, it was probably 5 months later that he gave them permission. So at that time, I should have gotten a letter. Yeah, I should have gotten my welcome letter. But I didn't, because he had already said no. And so that is one thing that we talked about at the last board meeting, is y'all need to talk to each other a little more frequently, because if things change, parents and families need to be involved in that discharge process. So I agree with what Jeremy is saying, that initial response needs to be compassionate and understanding. And I will give a shout out to Clackamas County sheriffs, because when my son had his break after that, you know, we got him, we took him to the hospital, they turned us away, and he had his break. They showed up, they put him in handcuffs, and I was like, oh my God, I wouldn't have called you guys if I would have known you were going to arrest him, because he had a warrant out for failure to appear. And the sheriff that showed up, and I don't remember his name, he said, you know, I understand, you know, my sister has schizophrenia. And I said, well, let me show you, you know, what happened. He's like, I'll look, but I understand what you're saying, so we're going to figure this out. And so he called the jail and was like, you know, what, I mean, if my son would have murdered somebody, they would probably would have taken him to jail first, but it was just a failure to appear. So this sheriff made the decision to take him to the hospital. And without that happening, we wouldn't be where we are right now.
It's so interesting to me, the touch points that make things happen within the mental health system. They're, I'm going to come out and say, illogical. One might say crazy. Yeah. Just a word. It's a word.
But it's a real word.
It is. And it, you know, disordered thinking. You're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Sitting in for Joanne Hardesty, I'm Lisa Loving. We are live in Studio 2 with Giovanni Shern. We're covering kind of a lot of territory
now.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
Before the top of the hour, we're going to come back to the thing that you can do, that wonderful coat drive. But right now, listeners, the phone lines are open. We know many of you all have DIY projects helping houseless people. As Giovanni even was talking about how many people helped her just track her son and try to figure out how to bring him home, because that's what you did. That's the goal. It wasn't to just get him off the streets. It was to bring him home.
Yes.
That's different. Okay. So call us up with your project and let us know how we can support you. Or if you know of a great program supporting mentally ill people, tell us about that. Let us know how we can support it. 503-231-8187. And we do have a caller. Barth, what's going on?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I don't have an individual project, although I must applaud your guest for her strength and for her expanding vision.
Thank you.
She's helping everyone around get, you know, some kind of a grasp on this. We are bombarded with information about the, quote, mental health crisis, unquote, and how that's filling up the jails and filling up the shelters and filling up the street corners. And it's difficult for, you know, the average person to know how to approach this. I understand you're going to have some ideas at the end of the show, and that's great. I wonder if there's any particular point of advocacy, you know, any specific political venue where they can be petitioned or dunned or pressured.
Yeah, what can we do politely, politically or policy-wise? That's a great question. Thanks for asking it. So
sure,
what do you think?
I'll just get mine off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, man. What do you have? I mean, the political aspect of mental health sometimes, I don't even know where to go with it or who's doing a good job with that. But what's your take, Giovanni?
So I was fortunate enough to participate in a NAMI lobby day where we got to go and talk to our senators and our representatives and just kind of say, this is why mental health is important and this is what you can do. I mean,
that's the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill,
yes.
NAMI, NAMI.
Yes, and they're an awesome resource as well, but they do a lot of things to change policy and law. So I would say get involved with them, volunteer with them. They have a lot of information about current laws and policies that are going on right now and a lot of barriers to those. Me personally, being on the advisory board is the first step for me, but I'm meeting with a lot of the heavy hitters. So Oregon Health Authority, I have a meeting with them next week. I just met with the psychiatric something board just to figure out what they did, you know, because they came up at a board meeting. I'm like, okay, well, what do you do? And so we met with the director over there for 2 hours, and she explained that. So educating yourself on what's out there, what's going on, and then really taking it to local level first and learning how you can. So I would love to have that answer, but I am on a mission to find that answer myself, because being on the hospital board, we affect the hospital, but how do we affect, you know, change outside of the hospital? How do we make it easier for parents or for loved ones to help their, you know, their loved one, without having to have them on the streets for 5 months before you can get that support? And so
freezing winter.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm trying to figure that out myself, and I will definitely share it once I do.
All right. And we do have another caller. The magical engineering pixie is just tap dancing as fast as he can. The next caller is anonymous. Anonymous, what's going on with you today?
I have some answers. I've been in this 20 years, and the nightmares don't get better. But we have some answers, and it takes too long, and I'm too disorganized this morning just to, you know, on the spur of the moment, make it succinct. But I would like to meet with her, hopefully maybe this weekend, because I'm going to be out of town, so we can start moving a project that will help 45 people with profound mental illness. And is there a way I can meet up with her?
Tell you what, we've already given some contact information. We'll give it again at the end of the show.
I don't have internet.
Okay, but we broadcast it, right? We broadcast it at this part of the show. You don't have internet. Tell you what, if you leave your phone number with John, okay, the magical engineering pixie, we'll give it right to Shivani. What do you think about that?
Here's where the problem is with that. And I know this sounds, everybody takes them a long time to understand this. I've had a long-term medical illness. If the phone wakes me up, it can put me in bed for a week. So I just want to, if she wants to set up a time for Saturday or Sunday to meet with me.
We'd have to somehow connect off air to make that happen.
Right.
So what are you... I mean, what's your suggestion?
Tell you what, Anonymous, why don't you call back right after 9 o'clock, and we'll try to connect you on the phone right here. And that's 503. It's the number you just called.
531-8187.
Yeah, and so thanks for stepping up with a burning hot DIY project. Really super appreciate it. That's exactly what we're talking about this morning. So thanks, Anonymous. And I think we might have another caller. We don't. So we've got 7 minutes left to show. Perfect amount of time to talk about the coat drive.
Yes. So,
if you just tuned in, we are live in Studio 2 with Up and Over founder Giovanni Shern. She's also got a piece of the entertainment industry. We didn't even go there yet, right?
Yeah, do a lot.
Up and Over does a lot, and this time of year, they're holding their, I think it's their 6th annual winter coat drive.
Fifth.
Go ahead, let people know one more time. Let's take a little bit of time, stretch our legs out, and talk about this coat drive and why it matters, and how you listeners can actually do something concrete right now to support the coat drive. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we have our 5th annual coat drive where we take youth preferably, the first preference is homeless youth, to shop for their own new coat. And we've set a goal of 100 coats this year. And the average sponsorship is $50, but you can give whatever you can give towards a sponsorship on the site. And you can find that link at www.upandover.net. And if you go over to How We Can Help, the drop-down menu will take you to youth sponsorship. And then it tells you more about our coat drive. And then at the bottom, you can pick the amount that you would like to sponsor a youth. Again, this is our fifth year. Last year, we did 46. We had a goal of 50. I would like to double that. And I just want to say, too, because of my son, we're in the process of working on a program called Someone Someone. Like your last caller said, you know, there's a way to help 45 people right now. And so through Someone Someone, that program will help people who want to advocate for their loved one. There was a lot of time and effort that went into helping my son. I know we're talking about the coat drive, mm-hmm. but I would not have been able to advocate for my son if I was working a 9-to-5 job. It would have just been impossible. And so we're trying to put this program together to help folks, and also somehow figure out how to get that mental health piece integrated into what we do in the schools. And so we're still developing that. But the coat drive means a lot to me this year because, like I said, I literally watched my son lay on the ground and sleep at the Gresham Transit Center in a tiny little jacket. God only knows where he got it from. So I just have a heart for people who have to do that. You know, and some people are out there because they don't have anywhere else to go, and some people are out there like my son who have a place to go, but because of their mental illness, they're not making the best choices for themselves. And so this coat drive this year is aggressive for me. 100 coats is a lot for us, considering we started at 7. If we can reach that goal, it would be awesome. It would mean a lot to a lot of kids. And don't get me wrong, I have accepted used coats, that because during the winter time I also go and hand out coats and gloves and hats to homeless. But our drive is specifically to take young people to shop for a new coat of their own, you know, to have some sense of pride, some sense of ownership, give them some confidence. It makes a big difference. It really does, to be able to do that. So,
and again, it's upandover.net or Up and Over on the Facebook page. You know, Giovanni, I don't know if you ever read Ken Kesey's novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. It was actually written in 1962 about the Oregon State Mental Hospital.
Oh, yeah.
Right? It really is about the Oregon State Mental Hospital. And I'm going to think about Jeremy's voice all day. I'm going to think about what he had to share. But for all of us who really care, and all of us who have mentally ill relatives, and all of us who have some mental illness, what should we be doing right now?
Educating yourself. I think my process would have went a lot faster if I would have done educated myself. I would say, just educate yourself on your loved one's illness, because knowing how to deal with them and knowing how to help them is going to help them better than just kind of running blind. Don't make excuses for not checking in on them. Let them know that you're there, but really just educating yourself on that mental illness that loved one has.
All right. I'm going to close out the show right now. I think there might be someone calling, and we love you, but next time we're going to have you call a little sooner. So I want to say thanks for tuning in. Connect with Giovanni Schoen at upandover.net. Look for the tab that says How You Can Help. Follow the link to youth sponsorship on Facebook. That's Up and Over. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to our engineer, John Shook. And I want to say stay tuned for Teresa Mitchell and Press Watch.
Get up, stand up for your right.
Good morning. It's 8:58. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up, Press Watch with Teresa Mitchell. She brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, we have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman talks to author Celeste Ng about her new novel, Little Fires Everywhere, a story set in suburban 1990s America that deals with questions of race, the comfort of privilege, and parenting. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. KBOO keeps you informed with all of this important programming like you just heard, and you can get involved by going to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member. It's 8:59.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of All the Rage, Thursday, October 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. All the Rage is a documentary that explores the work of physician Dr. John Sarno and his radical methods to treating back pain. Through the interviews with Sarno, patients, and experts, the film offers a profound rethink of how we approach our healthcare. Again, that's All the Rage, Thursday, October 12th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as